Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to WSI-sponsored Pagans Tonight Radio Network. Come explore news, information, entertainment, and ideas from a pagan point of view around the globe. Tune in every night for interviews and lively discussions on current events, philosophies, traditional and not-so-traditional practices, DIY projects, the who's who and what's what of our growing pagan community right here on Blog Talk Radio in English and now in Spanish.
And good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you're at in the world today. It could be any one of 202 countries that regularly visit our site. I'm your host, Ed the Pagan Hubbard, and with my one more time co-conspirator of this Wednesday show,
Tracy Logan Wood. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Mm-hmm. And so, I guess the thing is that this is going to be our last Wild Wednesday. And I've already had people asking, are you leaving the air? You know, people have misunderstood it, that Pagan Tonight was going away or that we were going away, period. And I kind of
explained, We're not.
We're not. This Wednesday show is going to go away. And it's going to be replaced next week by Pagan Water Radio.
So Ed and I together will be no more. And there is something kind of sad about that, because this Wednesday night show is kind of the foundation for the whole Pagans Tonight network. But you can still hear Ed on the air on Mondays nights with Marianne and on Sunday nights on Pagan Science Radio, and you can still hear me on the air on Friday nights.
And we reserve, because we are still going to be the station managers. We'll trace the station manager, and we're going to do specials from time to time. We want to focus on more, when we do things, we want to focus on more issues.
So what that means is that Ed and I will be doing specials on Friday nights after Pagan Priestess. We have deliberately left that slot open, so we won't be on every week, but we'll be doing specials. And I do believe we might be having our current guests on for perhaps another special somewhere down the road. So since we have a short period of time and we just came on the air, because this is going to be perhaps a very intense interview,
mm-hmm.
So I want to get to that.
Okay, go right ahead.
Tonight we have joining us, and I'm going to turn your microphones on, ladies, so I hope you got all your coughing and throat clearing out. So tonight, I love when I get giggled. So tonight we have joining us Laura Petsouris. Hello.
Hello.
And Galina Kraskova.
Hello.
Hello. So let me do like a quick bio for you people out there tuning into the show. So Laura comes from a long line of mediums, ancestor workers, and practitioners of the esoteric arts. She was born in Miami and was raised in the Cuban community before moving to New England. She started on this path at a young age when her beloved grandmother died, and she realized their bond remained strong and vital. Today, Laura lives in Connecticut with her family, works as a nurse, and teaches in ancestor work both locally and regionally. Her life's mission is to teach others to honor and work with their dead and to emphasize that ancestral obligations transcend cultural and religious boundaries. Yes. Whew, that was a mouthful. And Galina is a free range, see, and I'm totally going to screw her bio up because some of these words are like, whoa! But Galina is a free range tribalist heathen who has been a priest of Odin and Loki for close to 20 years. Originally ordained in the Fellowship of Isis in 1995, she is a member of Ironwood Kindred, Asatru in Frankfurt, the First Kingdom Church of the Asphodel. The American Academy of Religions and the Religious Coalitions for Reproductive Choice. She has been a state contracted expert in the Asatru faith and is currently involved in prison ministry. And I'm just going to go on to say that you have lots of diplomas and degrees, and you're currently in a program. And you are an experienced diviner, ordeal master, and conjure woman. And your primary interest is devotional work and the reconstruction of northern traditional shamanism.
That's
so
correct.
I have some links. So I will throw those in the chat room. So for those of you who like to listen and surf at the same time, I will throw those in there. So there are some links to where you can get Laura and Galena's books. So I wanted to throw that out before we even got into the interview. So welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
I am quite happy to have you. So let's see, where to get
started.
That's
quite an introduction, Tracy. That was very well done.
Well, you know, I made the effort to get the bios and make sure that I could talk about what each lady was kind of into a little bit. And get started well. So to jump right in, so Laura wrote this book, Weaving Memory, that we're talking about tonight, and Galena wrote the introduction. However, the two of you work together and do presentations on ancestor veneration. How did the two of you meet and start working together?
Laura, you want to take that one?
Sure. We were introduced via email by a mutual acquaintance who thought it would be a really good idea for she and I to touch base. And from there, we met in person and found out that we had a lot in common in terms of how we approach ancestor veneration and working with the ancestors. And we started, you know, working together out from there, which was really great. Not to jump in on Galena's take on it. I was amazed and stunned, though, the first time that, you know, I went and I saw how Galena does her ancestor work, because she got a lot of her ancestral practices from like a Cuban. So it was like old home week. It was old home week, and it was great.
I had no idea what a mark that left, what a specific and recognizable signature that
mm-hmm.
left on my ancestor work.
And yeah,
I know when I met Laura for the first time, I was like, hey, you're a medium, but you're grounded. But you're a medium. I had never seen that before, because I find that mediums who are not trained and people with this talent who aren't trained up in an indigenous environment, who aren't trained up in a specific indigenous religious culture, usually are out of their ever-loving minds and about as useful as a soap bubble.
Wow, that's kind of harsh.
It's accurate. Harsh, yeah. And part of it is that they just, you know, you'll see mediums who are encouraged to go cavort with everybody else's dead, but who have no ancestor practices of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's horrifying. I just want to take them and say, you've got to stop. First, get right with your own dead. First, learn to ground. First do X, Y, and Z, because you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, and I remember that conversation. It was very funny, because Galena was like, you're a medium, but you're grounded. What happened? And I was like, my grandmother, she had a chancleta. she raised me a certain way. And she, you know, she taught me like what to do, and I was very lucky to have her like growing up. And then even after she died when I was 10, but her two best friends were still alive, and they were still in the picture, and they were still in my life. So I grew up around mediums in the Cuban community who knew what they were doing and were very experienced and grounded. And, you know, I didn't get away with anything. And they were pretty much like, you know, this is how it needs to be. So that, you can have some measure of control, and you control your gift rather than your gift controlling or destroying you.
I want to jump in here for a second, because it's important to emphasize that for ancestor work, you don't have to be a medium. In a polytheistic mindset, ancestor work is what a responsible adult does. If you're a medium, hey, that's great. That makes it easier, but this is something everybody can do.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I think too many people think, well, I'm not a medium. Like, I'm just going to suck at it. I don't know what to do. But no, whatever you do, it's something. It's so fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Very true. So the next question I have that you kind of started to cover, how did you come to this work? Because you grew up in Miami and around a culture that venerates their ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
So how did this progress into working with the public? And so I want to give you a little bit of opportunity to give some mojubas to your grandma.
Very much like with my grandmother. My grandmother did this. Her mother did this. My great uncle did this. Everybody around us was involved. So it was very organic and natural. And I grew up in the culture, very steeped in it, very involved in the practices, like for the Egun, for the dead, for our ancestors. It was always a part of like the consciousness and like the practice. So how it eventually morphed into working with the public. After many years, I would just find, people kind of in conversation, other people I practiced with, people like coming to me, and they had a lot of questions about how to get started, how do I do this, how do I manage my ancestral connections, especially questions coming from people who didn't grow up in a community where that was an organic part of life. So they were feeling, disconnected, and what do I do? And everybody's got dead people. Everybody has ancestors. And mm-hmm. everyone can do this work to some degree or another. And it's an important connection to build and maintain. And I just kind of ended up getting involved with people and, teaching other people who I knew, about the practices, and then trying to teach, people who had no context for it, what they could do to begin to facilitate their own relationship with their dead.
And I think that's one of the things that I love that you actually put in the book, that you may not know your dead, but they absolutely know you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they do. I mean, I think that's one of the saddest things about our contemporary culture, that after over 1,000 years of monotheistic dominance, we've eaten this idea up that we're alone, that we are isolated. I'm like, no, we all have our dead, we all have our ancestors, and they're there, and they're in our court, just waiting for us to reach out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Galena, how did you come into ancestor work?
I belong to Odin, and he taught me rune work. And I was doing rune work, and I had an experience with our goddess of death, of the underworld, where basically I was severely chastised because I had not been honoring my dead. That only needs to happen once. So it was a fairly frightening experience. So at the time, I had a somebody in the roommate and a housemate, and I went and I knocked on his door, and I was apparently white as a ghost, and no pun intended, and I explained what had happened, and I knew that he had a strong ancestor practice, because that is such an integral part of the African traditional religions.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked him to help me get started, because when the goddess of the underworld, when our god, when Hela, gives you a comeuppance, you take note and you fix what needs to be fixed. So he took me to his elder, who sorted me out. And then it took me a good 10 years. I have to say, it was not an easy thing. Most people, I think, find it easier to connect to their dead than to the gods. For for me, Odin was such a strong presence in my life that it was, and Loki as well, that it was very, very difficult for me to give the time to the dead that they deserved. And there, you know, and it's hard when you don't have the best relationships with your immediate family. Sometimes you have to go back a bit further to make that connection. So it was like it was a good 10 years before things came together, and eventually things got sorted out. And even the occasional relative who had died, with whom I had a contentious relationship in life, the beautiful thing about ancestor work is that if they're willing and you're willing, you can work that out even after they die. And in some cases, so my dead were very, very helpful from the get-go. They were very helpful, and I would get little bits of encouragement here and there, just enough to keep me going when I thought this was that there was no hope of my ever getting my ancestor house in order. And then eventually, and thank God, well before I became a shaman, my ancestor house started sorting itself. And once my adopted mother died, she put my ancestor house in order. I find that often one or two ancestors will come forward and sort of kind of be handlers, and they will kind of hold the gateway between the living and dead, and they'll be your main point of contact, and they'll put everyone else in order, and she very much did that. But it was an ongoing process, but it's such an important part of the work, and I find that for most people, if you can get it right with your dead, regardless of whether you're a medium or not, if you can get it right with your dead, they will help you get it right with the gods. They will help you get it right with the elemental powers. And thankfully, that's what happened. When I started, you know, they were the ones that first really kind of ripped that post-conquest filter off my eyes. And they would sort of share their experiences with me and say, this is what we see when we look at your world. And it was horrifying. These are the points that we see out of balance. And then as my ability to sense them and my ability to interact with them grew stronger, they started sharing their physical experiences with me. This is how I died, defending my faith. The first time that happened was not too long ago, actually. It was a couple years ago. I speak for the military dead, and I do a lot of work with warrior dead, military dead. And I had gone on a pilgrimage to some battlefields, and I was on Gettysburg, and it was like I was being beaten. I didn't know what was going on. I was hysterical, and I called Laura.
I remember.
You remember that, right? Yeah, she is the best ancestor worker that I know. And
yeah, it sounds like a kind of a freaky experience.
Not freaky. I mean, the least it is my job to speak for them. And how can I speak for them if I have no concept of what they've experienced? Mm-hmm. As connected as I am to the military dead, and as much warrior medicine as I carry, I have not gone into combat in this lifetime. So how can I speak for them when I haven't crossed that chasm here, when I have not gone across that line from which there is no going back? It is right that they share their experiences with me. How can I fight this filter? How can I fight the horror that monotheism perpetrated on our lineages? How can I do anything to reconstruct and restore our ancestral traditions when I have no concept of what our ancestors went through to preserve them? It's right that they share those things with me. If a little bit of physical discomfort, okay, a lot of physical discomfort is what I have to go through, it's still less than what they went through. I got up and was able to walk away from it. Some of the men, young men that were sharing their experiences with me on Gettysburg are still under that ground.
Mm. Gotcha. Those body memories are very capable of downloading those. And very capable of downloading memories when they need to impart something really, really quickly, which can be incredibly disorienting in some ways and sometimes very physically uncomfortable, like very physically uncomfortable.
I actually find sharing their emotions, to be teaching a class on ancestor work, where we are talking about the destruction of our traditions and having a Saxon war leader standing behind me pouring the depths of his anger and his rage and what he had seen as his people felt as Charlemagne, it was not the body memory so much that's so difficult to handle. It's the, I think for me it's the emotional impact.
Yeah.
That lays me out.
I can see that. So I want to give a quote from the book. And this is from the foreword that is by you, Galena, because it was a little bit of what you were talking about. So I want to kind of, you know, give little teasers to encourage people to go buy the book.
Buy Laura's book.
Particularly if you're interested in working with your dead.
Mm-hmm.
So Galena says, our world is hopelessly out of balance. So many indigenous traditions, including our own, as heathens and pagans, have been sundered. It's going to take both sides of that equation to return some semblance of right relationship. It's going to take the living and the dead working in tandem, learning how to honor the dead and getting one's ancestral house in good working order is a good first step towards reestablishing that balance. It is the equivalent of building the foundation of a house. The foundation must be so strong and deeply rooted, balanced and well constructed, or the house will not last. So that brings me around to the next question I have, which is, what role do you think ancestor veneration should play in religious work? Why
I think it's absolutely fundamental. It is the first thing that if people do nothing else but honor their dead, they have done something important, something fundamental, and something profound. I think that it is absolutely essential. And I would never have said this 10 years ago, but even before you begin honoring the gods, I think you need to get it right with the dead. There's a Lithuanian proverb that I love, because my father's side of the family is Lithuanian, and I have some really, really strong female dead on that line, that goes, the spirits of the dead are protection for the living. And there's a Yoruban proverb that teaches us that we stand on the bones of our ancestors.
Mm.
I don't think it's possible to build a sustainable tradition without first paying homage to the dead and without first picking up those threads and taking up again the ancestral contracts, taking up again that process of reweaving them.
Ashe. I absolutely agree. I think it's the foundational practice. There is a reason why when you go and in Santeria, when you go and you're going to a ritual, before you even get to honoring the Orisha, first you honor the dead. There are foundation and there are link. And to me that's just so intimately connected.
And they're a conduit. Think about it. Being in that liminal place, they are not amongst the living, but they are not deities. They can bridge that gap.
Yes, exactly.
It can help us have a good relationship with the gods.
Exactly. And they can stand in that gap and teach us what we need to know to get into that right relationship and that respectful mindset.
I got you. I want to stop you for a minute. Now, somebody, I want to address a couple things in the chat room. So somebody says they've never been clear on the difference between pagans and heathens. So I want to say that we're going to have Galena come on later and soon, not later as in real soon, but, you know, maybe when Ed and I get our bearings about doing the specials. And she's going to come
I
on and talk all about
sense.
Heathenry.
Heathenry is the reconstruction of the indigenous traditions of Northern Europe before Christianity. When I say I'm heathen, what I mean is that I predominantly honor the Norse gods.
Okay, that was a good short answer. Somebody in the chat room says, I don't want to honor my dead. They didn't believe the way that I do, and they didn't approve of me and my beliefs. Although
you
they loved me, I'm sure. Said, although they loved me, I'm sure, I still don't want to talk to them. So I wanted to let you guys
Yeah. You have been far enough. You have ancestors back until the time that the first amphibian crawled out of the primordial ooze. And if you go back further, you have the elemental powers. At some point, if you go back far enough, you have ancestors who would completely approve, if I'm assuming you're pagan from because you're listening to the show, you have ancestors who were polytheists. You have ancestors who were animists. Your Christian ancestors or your monotheistic ancestors are not your only ancestors. And I got to tell you, it's amazing what death does to in terms of waking people up. I mean, the average, I'm no fan of monotheism, but the average one of our relatives were indoctrinated and poisoned. They were living the best life they could under mental conquest. They grew up in a religion and a culture that is inculcated with that religion that taught them shame and fear and divisiveness. Freud posited that the beginning of religious intolerance was monotheism, and I completely agree. You do not see the type of xenophobia. You do not see in polytheism, diversity is built into the system.
Mm-hmm.
In monotheism, it is not. Just go back further.
Mm-hmm.
And
somebody in the chat room says. Somebody in the chat room says the trouble with monotheism is that you can't get a second opinion.
That's true.
That's true.
But our ancestors they predate that, and I've had a lot of people ask me like, what do I do if all the people who I know in my family who have died are just, you know, complete dicks. And I said, well, it's statistically impossible that everyone back to mitochondrial Eve was just like a total loser.
Have at least one in our line, believe
we,
me.
It's also statistically impossible that we don't have some real idiots up in there. But we can, you know, connect with the ones that are coming forward to connect. And I found that especially, you know, with polytheists rebuilding their traditions, we have ancestors that were animists. We have ancestors who were polytheists who have been waiting with, like, bated breath, you know, for some of, like, the storm to pass, for us to have the opportunity and the chance to rebuild these traditions that they lived for, and they lived for it in a really organic way. We have ancestors who were raised in it, who had generations of people who practiced these faiths, and that's what I'm talking about with the rebuilding of these traditions. That's such an important link, because if we tap into that, they can teach us how to get it right, and how to get it right not just with the mind of someone who is postmodern and who grew up in a society where monotheism is the dominant paradigm. They can teach us how to regain our indigenous mind of how we were when we were polytheistic tribal peoples who, you know, had close contracts with our ancestors, who had close contracts with the spirits of the land and our deities. So we have ancestors who know that and who lived it. And so even if the last 1,000 years are a wash in your family, there is somebody back before that who's been waiting, trust me. They've been waiting and watching for an opportunity for someone to pick up those threads, and they're more than willing to partner with us in the rebuilding of the traditions.
And as far as ancestor goes, I also include friends that have died and mentors and teachers. And as a priest and a shaman, I include everyone who did that work before me. That is my lineage, as opposed to my bloodline. So, I mean, ancestor is a really broad term. There is someone for you. And if you take those steps to start honoring your dead, it may take a little while. It took me 10 years. But you can sort it out. You don't have to work with the ancestors that hurt you. And you don't have to work with ancestors that you yourself simply cannot feel as though you are validated as a human being when you're in their presence, go back further.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of things that are going to come up for anybody doing ancestor work, and I'm going to put that out there right now. There, if you go back far enough, for those of us coming of Northern European descent, there are two ancestral wounds that we will initially hit. The first is that our indigenous traditions were destroyed. When you talk about reconstructing and when you talk about restoration, it begs the question of what happened? Where did it go? Why do I have to restore it? And the answer to that question is the spread of monotheism across Northern Europe with a religious genocide. The second thing that comes up, I would add, with first, some of your ancestors fought and some colluded, and there's a debt there. Because the second wound is what that did. After the ideological conquest of Europe, perhaps for survival, perhaps for reasons we'll never know, our people ate that poison and came across the water and did it to others. We became the destroyer of nations. Our ancestors turned into monsters in the name of Christ. And sooner or later, that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are dead who carry tremendous anger and tremendous pain. And we, if they could go through it, we can witness it. And we can look at that and decide what we are going to do and how we are going to repair our ancestral lines, how we are going to pay the debt that we have to the people our ancestors ravaged.
Mm.
And that level of reparation is part of ancestor work, too.
Mm. Wow, thank you for all of that. I can recognize in your voice.
It's an
emotional issue for you. Well, that came out wrong. Not an emotional issue, but you're very emotionally connected. That came out wrong. You're emotionally connected to the ancestors and
if you
the ignoring
the
that's going
you
on.
And not be emotionally connected to the imbalance and the disease and the horrors that happen every bloody day, then I question the humanity of that person.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, and I'm the biggest misanthrope that you'll find, it's my dead that woke me up to that, and it's their emotion that's pouring through me now.
Mm-hmm.
This
I
is
gotcha.
Warrior work, and if you're not a warrior, you better learn how to be.
Yeah. There's a great amount of charge among a lot of our ancestors, like regarding this. There's a lot of healing that needs to be done on all, you know, by all parties on all continents. I know that, like, I feel it very personally. I have ancestors from three continents. You know, I've got ancestors that were indigenous to the Americas. I have ancestors from Africa, and I have ancestors from Europe. And just there's so much there that all of them carry in different ways. From the impact of what happened when indigenous cultures met and fell under the sword and were conquered. And then, you know, the conquest that happened in the Americas to Native American people, the African Holocaust of the Maafa and the ancestors who were brought across the water, the bottom of the Atlantic is a trail of bones, a
uh-huh.
trail of bones for the millions who died through the Middle Passage. Those pains are real, and I think the ancestors are very much crying out for their descendants to look at what happened, not just to know them, but to also reconnect, and they need healing, we need healing. I don't think that we can get right until we address some of their realities and some of their stories, because they're crying out to be known. I was blessed to attend last summer an event on Coney Island that was a lot of people from the African diaspora, from both the U.S. and from the Caribbean, meeting, and it was an incredibly powerful and beautiful day of drumming, people from like all kinds of African traditional religions coming together, and all in ceremonial white dress, bringing the drums down to the water, bringing songs, you know, bringing flowers, bringing offerings, bringing like cane syrup and molasses to pour into the waters as offering and remembrance as a community for all of those who died during that middle passage, and as part of, you know, letting them know that they're remembered, and that those of us who have ancestors who made that journey, that we have not forgotten the price that they paid, and we have not forgotten our traditions, that we have not forgotten our ancestors, we have not forgotten our Orisha, we have not forgotten who we were and who we are, and working together, we're moving towards who we will be. That no matter what was done, that there, that is a story of survival. And part of that survival is reclaiming what was taken. And it's never
Absolutely.
Too late. Never too late. Sankofa, it is never too late to go back and pick up what was left behind or what was taken from you. It is never too late. And they're there with that. And they're there with that on every continent. You know, no matter where you come from, you have
okay.
ancestors, and you have, like, indigenous practices that were your practices, you know. And those are things that are waiting to be reclaimed, because, like, those things for you know, some of us were lucky that some of that survived. I count myself blessed every day that my family, in the middle of, you know, untold horrors that they went through from West Africa to Cuba, that there were women in my line who fought and scrapped to hold on to those traditions,
mm-hmm.
and they passed it down. They didn't pass everything down, because I'm sure there was some that was lost or, you know, did not survive it, but they passed everything along that they could. And it's that feeling of connection that's very sustaining. And we all have ancestors who have things that, you know, they have to teach us. And they want us very much to remember who they were and who they are and where they come from, so that we can understand who we are.
Absolutely.
And our ancestors did not go gently into the dark night of conquest.
Oh, hell no.
They did not go gently. I'm being very, very pushed here, just as an aside. People often say, you talk about conquest, it's not happening now. Yes, it is. And it may not be happening with guns and blades, but it's happening. It happens in our minds every day. It happens in the way that we are programmed to treat anyone who doesn't look like us. It happened in the Ukraine on November 1st when a bunch of Christian vandals destroyed a sacred statue to the Slavic god Perun. May their ancestors forget their names.
Yeah, it happens every day on reservations with uranium poisoning. It happens every day, you know, in cities where there are young people who are just completely lost, because their ancestral traditions have been broken, and all they have is the religious language that was inflicted upon them to try and keep them docile, you know,
mm-hmm.
and keep them in chains, you know, and it's a reclaiming of self and ancestors, because to me, I don't think that there is a complete differentiation there, because I don't see a separation. You know, you can't know yourself fully without knowing your ancestors.
Right.
And even
you
if you
know where you're going.
Yep.
You
we
can't
are
know where you're going if you don't know where you've been.
Yep.
We are our ancestor lines walking. We are the living incarnation. I'm quoting Laura here from one of the many conversations that we've had. We are the living incarnation of our ancestor lines walking.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
We have an obligation not just to ourselves. We have an obligation to the people that came before us, and we have an obligation to the people that are going to come after us. And it's about time we woke up and realized that.
Mm-hmm. And an obligation to
Absolutely.
One another. And to one another, too, because we had an interesting conversation recently, Galina, about this whole idea of disconnect and how it's much easier to indoctrinate someone who is isolated, and that one of the things that came along with monotheism and the idea that there is only one way to do it, and that way is our way, and let us tell you how to do it, because there's going to be someone supervising you.
And you have to do it alone.
Exactly. The idea of individual salvation. And for a lot of us who come from cultures where that is not a concept, where, you know, you have a community, you have a village, you have your ancestors, you have a network of people. And that's an alien concept, you know. Galina, you got to tell the story about the anthropologist who was like befuddled by these kids in Africa. You tell it better than me.
It's a meme that I saw running around Facebook, and I don't know if it's true, but oh my God, I hope it is. This anthropologist was doing field work in Africa, and he got permission from the village to do a social experiment with some of the children. And so when they were out playing, he took this big basket of fruit and candies and good things, sweet things, and he put it by a tree. And he lined all the kids up like they were getting ready to run a race some distance from the tree. And he said, the first one who reaches the tree, when I say go, can have all of that. And the children took each other's hands, and they ran as a group to the tree. And later, as they were all sitting around in a circle sharing all of the sweets, the anthropologist said, why did you do that when one of you could have had everything? And one of the boys said to him, how could I be happy knowing that my friends were hungry? I have a strong ancestral ally. He comes forward sometimes, and he was a Bronze Age tribal leader. And he was himself. And that's all I'm going to say. Not the nicest man, but he was a good leader. And I was dialoguing with him at one point and talking about our world and talking about, I think I shared that story with him. And his response was, I was responsible for every single member of my tribe. I was responsible for keeping them healthy, safe, and fed. If a single person in my tribe went hungry, I did not have the right to eat.
Hmm.
This was not a nice man. This was not someone whom you would want to go up against.
Gotcha. I hate to say it, but we need to move on to other stuff because we're running out of time.
Understood.
So I want to briefly go into, the book is broken up into three pieces, sort of. So the dead, the working, and other voices. So there's lots of good chapters and stuff if you're interested in working with your ancestors. I highly recommend that you buy this book. I did. Because there's lots of good stuff in here. So to move on from there... Laura, you really wanted to talk about how everybody should be doing this,
mm-hmm.
that it's the basis for strong spiritual practices.
Mm-hmm.
So how do people really get started?
Okay. The best way is by doing and connection, because I have a lot of people who are very hesitant because they're afraid, you know, I'm not going to be able to do it right, or I'm not going to be able to do it within my spiritual context. And most traditions do have some form or way of working to honor their dead. And one of the things that I tried to emphasize with the book is that no matter where you're coming from, what level of background, what culture you are, what, you know, experience you have, you can begin to do things and incorporate some practices to begin to lay a foundation with that. For me, I have an ancestor shrine in my house. Now, that can be for people out there, that could be something really relatively simple. If you have people who you love dearly who are members of your family who have passed, it can include photographs of them. And I'm going to have a Cuban moment and emphasize that if you're putting these pictures out, do not have pictures of living people in them, because that's way bad luck. Okay, that's like something you do not want to do. Like, if necessary, Photoshop yourself out of the picture before, you know, putting Grandpa on the ancestor shrine. That it's a place where you can light a candle. It's a place where you can do what you're moved to do. It signifies you giving them space in your home, in your life. If you don't have pictures, that's fine. I mean, photographs are a fairly recent invention.
I want to just pop in here. So, a friend of mine, my own sister, puts a mirror on the altar for people who don't have any pictures at all, because you carry your ancestors with you.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah.
Sorry,
no, it's a very good idea. Like, you can have things like soil from the place where you come from, things that you associate with your particular ancestors. It's a place to invite them in. It's a contact point. And there's something about kind of tending it, spending a few minutes there on a daily basis, letting them know, tell them, hey, I really want to connect with you. I want you to have a place in my life and in my consciousness and in my home. And tell them what's going on in your life. If you're having a celebration like a birthday, a graduation, you know, cut them a slice of cake too. You know, put it out for them and, you know, here, you know, you're a part of this. You remain a vital part of our life, even though you're not walking around in a meat suit anymore. You're still part of the family. And they really appreciate that kind of ongoing interchange. I think one of the places where you know, we just went through, like, Samhain. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Samhain was just passed. And people are pretty good at, like, Samhain of, like, okay, now, like, we're going to honor the dead. Okay, there's another 364 days
mm-hmm.
that are not Samhain. Okay, and coming to them, if you're going through hard times, spending some time with them, talking with them, thinking about, you know, there's pretty much nothing under the sun that we could be going through now that some of our ancestors have not gone through and have not survived, and worse. And while some people think that's kind of like a morbid thought, the way I was taught is that basically we have been paid for. Our ancestors, we are the culmination of their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations. And all of us, no matter where we come from, we had ancestors who struggled and scraped and had maybe no hope of any joy in their own life, but they poured all of that love and devotion into making sure that their children survived and their
mm-hmm.
children's children. You know, we're not any of us here at this juncture in time because we had ancestors who flaked out and didn't know how to get through things.
Right.
So drawing comfort, it's fine to go and say, you know, I need a little extra strength right now. I need a little extra help right now. My only caveat with that is, like, don't be the relative who only calls when you need bail money at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, if they show up for you and they're there and present for you, it's fine to go to them in the hard times. Remember them also when things are good. You know, make sure that you have that ongoing point of connection. You know, talk to your kids. If you have it, or young people in your family. I have a friend who's sort of like, he doesn't have kids of his own, but he is sort of like the memory keeper for his family. And he's the one who, you know, when his nieces and nephews get married, like, will pass along, you know, great-grandfather's pocket watch and tell stories about, like, this was belonged to your great-grandfather. Let me tell you about him. And pass those memories along. Share family stories. Share family photographs. Let them know. Like,
cook if you have family recipes.
Excellent.
It's the most essential form of nourishment. Cook all those recipes your grandma made. You know, it's or for some of us, running our studying our genealogy is a good way to get started. For me, as a linguist, learning my ancestral languages.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Laura, you have a really simple morning thing that you do with your grandma. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, yeah. Most mornings.
Because I just want to express, like, how simple it could be.
Yes, how simple it can be. It's the continuity of it. Getting up in the morning and talking to her. I'll make myself some coffee. I'll make her, if I'm making coffee for myself, I make her some coffee. Talk with her about stuff. I read the Baraja, which are like cards that it's like the Latin American version of tarot cards, but not quite. She read them as well. So if I need to do divination, like frequently, you know, early in the morning, I get up. I'm having coffee. She's got her coffee. I'm reading the Baraja. You know, I first picked up the Baraja. I picked up her deck, you know, as a girl. She, you know, she did that same form of divination. So whenever I read Baraja, she's very present with me. So I may sit down, or it may be something else. Like, I'm not saying that everyone out there should get a Baraja deck and go to. I'm just saying that those points of contact, you know, if there's someone that you loved who, you know, died and loved baking, you can do that. If there's someone who died who was close to you who was a really good craftsperson and you are interested in that craft, that's a great way to connect. But just as simple as sitting there and making a cup of coffee and bringing them a cup of coffee. And, you know, it's like you're still here. I'm still, you know, I'm still here. And, like, that connection remains vital. And it's like the talking to every day, you know, and always being aware of their presence on a daily basis, you know, and kind of checking in that going up and tending the ancestor altar, lighting a candle, bringing some fresh, cool water. I mean, that's also a big thing. In Cuba, like glasses of water, like on the altar for the dead. So just kind of, you know, kind of getting into like a routine of sometime morning, evening, whenever, of just checking in for a few minutes. Like, it doesn't need to be a huge elaborate, you know, a huge elaborate ritual. It's just like checking in, and over time, just like any relationship with anyone. You know, the time that you put into the relationship determines the quality of the relationship and what you get back. And there are protections that come from having a well-tended and intact ancestor house that, you know, I cannot overestimate, you know, and tell you, like, I can't say enough about that, because there are times when, you know, when I've had, you know, trouble, or there's been danger or danger to someone close I care about, where either my ancestors have sorted it or my ancestors have warned me ahead of time so that, you know, I could take action immediately and prevent, you know, something tragic from occurring. So like
right.
they will act on your behalf, especially if you know they have a very strong relationship with you. It increases their interest, you know.
Absolutely. And so you're saying throughout the book that it's really more about give than about take. It's a service.
It is. I mean, it is very much for me. I'm a you know, dedicated ancestor worker. I'm like the person in my generation and my family that kind of tends like my ancestral line, especially on my mother's side of the family.
But it's mutually beneficial. I mean,
but mutually, yeah, definitely mutually beneficial. And
we honor them, they protect us.
Yeah, exactly. It's a very dynamic thing.
So we have 5 minutes left. Mm-hmm. So I want you ladies to tell the audience like where you can be found until we have you on again.
I maintain a blog at craftcova.weebly.com. I think that you put the link up, I believe.
Yeah.
To my blog.
So they can't see the link in our archive.
Yeah, so you can find me via that link. I'm around Amazon. I'll be in London over the holidays. I'll be speaking at Treadwell's Bookshop in London, I believe on the 5th of January, if I'm not mistaken. I have the dates up on my blog. I have an event date.
Yeah,
and you catch me around. I maintain my blog fairly regularly.
So, Laura, what can we find you?
I am not a blogger. So it's not that I'm hard to find. It's just that I don't have, like, a blog per se. Galena's going to kill me.
Do you not have a public human, public figure Facebook page?
I have my own actual Facebook page. So I am on Facebook, and I can and have been in the past been messaged there, and you can find me there.
You need to get in touch with her, and you can.
I was
going to
say, like, you can find me through Galena. I can be found through Galena because she always knows where I can be found. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. So I have like a final quickie question, and of course it's going to be hard for you to answer this in less than 2 minutes. You said that every Indigenous culture knows that the partition between the living and the dead is an illusion, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that what do you say to people who don't have cultural references or come from a monotheistic traditional background? What advice would you give them to starting out?
Start. Because once you start, that'll get you sorted.
Yeah, they will really help get that sorted, tremendously so. Mm-hmm. They everybody has ancestors and dead people. That's kind of like the universal experience. And it's a very strong access point. So I would recommend beginning with some ancestor practice and like putting like your own ancestral house in order, and tending them and letting the ones who, you know, especially if you're in the process of trying to reclaim a tradition or rebuild a tradition, to reach out for those ancestors who know that work. Because they will teach you how to get it right with everyone else. Because they have a vested interest. They have a vested interest in you and your success and the success of their descendants and their line. So they're a powerful resource and ally, and to not leave that, I mean, you don't want to leave that untapped because it's such a powerful and tremendous resource that's there,
important to have everything you can
mm-hmm.
of that resource. It is important to root yourself, and the experience of how your ancestors come to you will be different for every single person,
mm-hmm.
but it will happen.
Mm-hmm.
You will have what you need.
Very good. So I put your names in the chat room again. So we've been speaking with Laura Patsouris and Galena Kraskova. So If you forgot everything they said about contacting them, the names are in the chat room.
You can also find me on
witchesandpagans.com.
You can find me on witchesandpagans.com. I maintain a blog there called Heathen Heretic. It's because I have a column in the magazine Witches and Pagans.
Right.
You can find me there, too.
Right, so we can find you there. And so it is time for us to end our show. So this is our final finale, and Ed was so quiet during the whole interview, so it was kind of like the Tracy farewell show.
It was. I tried to ask a question once, but I got totally trampled over, so it's okay. It's okay. If people can hear me this Sunday when I take on the question, the science of the gods, are they there? Do they exist? Is there any scientific evidence? So listen to me Sunday.
Absolutely. So thank you, ladies. I hope that you are open to coming back and chatting with us again.
Excellent.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Tracy.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. So that is kind of it for Ed and I and the final episode of Wild Wednesday until we do a special sometime in the future. So thank you, everybody, who has supported us and tuned in and all that great stuff. We love you very much. And what says you, Mr. Hubbard?
You said everything. It might not be quiet. So I guess it's time to go over to Oberon and Ariel.
Good night, everybody. Blessed be.
Welcome to the magical world of Oberon and Ariel. Their continuing mission to explore strange new realms, to seek out new paradigms and new possibilities, to boldly go where no show has gone before. And now, over to Oberon and Ariel.
Good evening. I'm Oberon.
And I'm Ariel.
And this is our show.
Well, first let's start out with the news of the day. You know, I watched the whole election last week, and it was pretty weird because I really didn't expect it to go so well. But the news that's come out in the last week is even more bizarre, okay? The reactions to Obama winning, all right? There have been people in every single state in America that have filed petitions to secede.
Really?
Out today. Yes.
Good Lord. Some
you
people
know,
are just poor
like,
losers, aren't they?
Really?
Damn.
Really.
Boy.
At first it was like a handful, and it just kept growing. It was over 20 and then over 30, and now it's every single state, you know?
Great. Well, let them go, man, you know?
It really.
Yeah.
And then another weird example of this is somebody, Denny's franchise owner.
Yeah.
Okay. He's now going to be imposing a surcharge for Obamacare.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Jeez.
I could not think this one up. I'm pretty smart, but I could not think this one up.
Wow.
Crazy,
wow.
You know? It's going to be interesting to see where it all shakes out, you know? It's going to be real interesting. Meanwhile, Obama has vowed to restore the middle class, and he has done student loan reform. And given us national health care, and that's better than most any president's given us in a long time.
Well, that's great. Well, I can see how the incredibly rich people who donated billions of dollars to the Romney campaign are pretty pissed about all their money going down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only a handful of people. I really don't quite understand why people who are not part of that 1% are so upset. You know, that's the part I don't get.
Well, you've got a lot of racists and bigots.
I guess it's just that. It's just that.
Yeah.
Well, how about that?
Mm-hmm.
So, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest tonight is Lasara Firefox Allen. Lasara is an internationally published best-selling author, coach, educator, spiritual advisor, and activist. And her book, Sexy Witch, which came out by Llewellyn in 2005, is published in 4 languages and distributed globally. And after 7 years, Sexy Witch is going into a 4th English language printing and a 2nd printing in both Spanish and Czech.
Wow.
As in Czechoslovakian.
Well, I know that my husband Tom read Sexy Witch, and he absolutely raved about it. And he does that with very few books, actually. And he thinks everybody ought to read this, men too. I mean, he just thinks that it was just a wonderful, wonderful book. And I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but anyway. So in addition to coaching, Lasara has picked up the cards again and is offering tarot readings. Both coaching and tarot readings can be performed in person or via phone, Facebook chat, iChat, or Skype.
Lasara has offered workshops and teleclasses on topics relating to relationships and intimacy, sexuality, parenting, media literacy as it relates to body image and self-esteem, writing, and spirituality.
Even though Lasara thought she was done, guiding groups through Sexy Witch in teleseminar format, the most recent time she ran the course 2 years ago, Sexy Witch is back by popular demand. The course is starting in late January and ending around spring equinox. Perfect Yule gift for the witch who has everything, right?
Married to the love of her life, Robert Allen, and mother to 2 amazing daughters, Lasara and her family live in the wilds of Northern California. They surround themselves with a community of loving, like-minded souls. Morning Glory and I lived for 8 years on Greenfield Ranch with Lasara and her large family, and we've known Lasara all her life. We love her and her kids dearly, and we consider her our niece. She was ordained in the Church of All Worlds in 1999, is our youngest priestess ever, and served for 2 years as president of the CAW Board of Directors.
Mm-hmm. Find out more at LasaraAllen.com. That's capital LASARA, capital ALLEN.com. Also, TarotWithLasara.com. That's all in lowercase. Tattoos and Tomatoes. .com, and no caps on that, or find her on Facebook.
All right. So welcome to our show, Lasara. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you both so much. I'm really pleased to be here, and hi, I miss you guys.
Oh, we miss you too. It's just fun to have you on the show, though.
Yeah, you're always up to something interesting. And can you tell us a little bit about what Sexy Witch is about for those who have not read it yet, for those unfortunate souls who haven't read it yet?
Definitely, but I'm going to tell you first that I'm on day 3 of a juice fast right now, and I'm just cleansing like crazy, so if you hear me sniffling, that's what's going on. I'm just kind of have to breathe through it, but impromptu juice cleanse. So,
all right.
So my voice is a little scratchy, but so Sexy Witch is designed as both a book that you can read and a book that you can read and work. So some people are going to just read the book and not necessarily do the exercises, although it has a lot of different exercises that will give people an opportunity to delve really deeply into their sense of self. And then there are also 2 addendums, basically. One is for someone who wants to practice to actually do the initiation cycle that Sexy Witch is. It's a 7-week initiation or 7-chapter initiation cycle. So there's an addendum for a solo practitioner, and then there's an addendum that's very similar for group practitioners, people who want to work as a group. And that's the format that I use in my classes. Sexy Witch is basically the first few chapters are dedicated very much to sort of deconstructing one's own persona, but not just persona from an internal sense, but like looking at all of the context that we grow into ourselves in, from family to culture to religions of origin to media influence. And basically the first number of chapters are sort of like peeling the layers back, and then when we get to the middle of the book, we start rebuilding from a very raw, very sort of vulnerable, very deep place. And From that place, we rebuild ourselves as, you know, our own best self that we are, that we're becoming right now in this moment.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Have you always been a writer, or did you discover this amazing talent later on?
I've always been a writer, actually, and I knew from a very young age, actually, that I wanted to write. I was a voracious reader as a kid, and as you know the the Greenfield history of, you know, not having a huge amount of interaction. We were very isolated. I grew up in a large family, but I didn't have peers aside from my siblings. I read so much, and through reading, I got to experience the world outside of a very sort of insular community. I also sort of like really personalized the books that I read. I got very into the stories and really came to know the characters as like people in my life. So reading had a huge influence on me, everything from fiction to nonfiction to, you know, I remember doing research about the Mayans and cultural dress in Central America, and I was homeschooled, so I would write book reports on and different like anthropological studies on things like cultural dress, like the difference in tribes between different regions in Mexico and Central America. So I've always found reading to be so vital, and I've always felt drawn to express myself through writing.
Oh, I remember coming up there to your place up at Castle Yonder and having whole evenings just sitting around telling stories and sharing stuff like that. And you wrote for Green Egg quite a lot, too. You were a regular columnist for years and stuff back in the 90s and all.
I did. I wrote for Green Egg. I wrote for New Witch when it first came out. I had a column with them. I've been actually pretty widely published. Sexy Witch is my only full-length book. But I have had pieces published in numerous anthologies. I don't even know off the top of my head how many. And I've even written for textbooks. I've written for a piece for an encyclopedia. I've done tons of article writing for different online and print journals. Basically, I've been all over the place as far as topics. But solidly in the nonfiction genre.
All right.
So after this break from facilitating and teaching the Sexy Witch course, what brought you back to it?
Well, I really felt sure last time. I was like, this is the last time I'm doing it. Get on the bus or you're going to miss it, you know. And I felt very sure about that. I had just done one cycle where I ran two courses of Sexy Witch concurrently, two different nights in the week. I was teaching 20-some people. You know, the class sizes are limited. And then I did another cycle almost immediately after that, and I was doing another, like, more advanced, different program at the same time, running two courses concurrently. And we're talking weekly courses, so it's a lot of output of energy. And I was like, okay, I'm done. Like, I've just worked the book three times in, you know, a six-month period. You know, and as a teacher, I'm sure both of you know, as you know, when you're in the process of priestessing or priesting or teaching or facilitating whatever capacity, you're doing the work too.
Yes.
You end up, you know, when you provide an initiation for others, you are also experiencing the initiation for yourself. Mm-hmm. And in my personal experience, it's, you know, and I know, Oberon, you know, after years and years of working with you and even recent working together, you know exactly what I'm talking about when I say you can't separate yourself out from the work.
Right, right.
You know,
you become the work.
Comes you, you know,
yep.
It's in you. And so even if your job hypothetically is to be midwifing other people through the process, we're having our own initiations as we do so.
Well, you start out thinking you're doing the work, and eventually you realize the work is doing you.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a level of commitment that I need to come to teaching Sexy Witch or any course with, and I felt like I had done the material enough times that I was like, okay, I'm finished. And I was actually looking for someone to train as my sort of to take it over from me, and that never really panned out. And so just recently people started saying, when are you going to do this again? We need, you know, we need this, and et cetera. And then I got a letter from Llewellyn saying that the book had been bought for second printing in by the Czech company and by the company in Mexico, and it's going into, I believe, its fourth printing at Llewellyn. It's featured in this the Yule holiday Llewellyn catalog. This book is 7 years old and it's still front listed.
Wow.
It's kind of, you know, I mean, just the other day I was talking to my husband, I was saying, you know, it's weird. I don't like to think about it too much because it makes me feel weird. I have weird feelings about taking credit for anything. But when I think about it, it's a pretty amazing thing, really, that this book, my book, you know, Sexy Witch, has been translated. It's available in four languages, and it's still being published at a pretty good rate 7 years later. And so what that tells me is that it is needed, that work isn't done with me. And so when people started knocking on my door, and then I got that, you know, figuratively knocking on my door, and then I got that letter from Llewellyn and a check, a larger check from Llewellyn than I've seen in a while because of the new acquisitions from the publishing companies or the reacquisitions.
Nice.
I was like, okay, got it. All right, I'll do it. And then I made a deal with the universe, which was, and I raised the rate because I was charging too little before to make it really worth my while. I raised the rate a little bit, and then I said if I can get five people registered by October 15th, the course isn't starting until the end of January. I said if I can get five people registered by October 15th, I'll do it. I had three people paid by October 15th and two people in negotiations. And I said, okay. And I have five people registered, and I'm I took a break because of the election. I'm a fanatic about elections, and so I had to like put everything else on pause for a little bit. And now I'm coming back to promoting Sexy Witch again, and you know, hoping to fill the course pretty easily, and it looks like that's going to happen. So,
all right. Well, as a lifelong political activist, how do you feel about the election?
Well, you know, I was scared to death in the days leading up to the election, thinking that there was a chance in hell that Romney would win, and I felt like there was. You know, all the numbers, all the statistics were saying that, all the polls were saying that, and Robert, my husband, was like, no, it's not possible. Like that can't actually be the outcome that's going to happen. But we both pretty, you know, like intense about it. And I campaigned very hard for Obama, you know, last time around. And of course, I know a lot of people feel like he hasn't followed through on everything that he said that he would, and while that may be true, I know also that there are a lot of forces that, as the president, you have to deal with negotiating that we have no idea about. And it's not just negotiating like backroom deals. I'm talking about, you know, like the real stuff that we just don't have the time to learn how it works.
Nothing happens without compromise in politics. Nothing.
And this total unremitting opposition from the Republicans, just absolutely stymieing to him everything. There's no couldn't do anything, you know, just unbelievable.
Absolutely, and that was part of it. And I also truly and honestly believe that he was playing a safe hand for the first term, and I think it was a smart move.
Yeah.
And I think that now that he's in office, and I was saying it, you know, to all of my liberal friends and lefty friends, I was saying, you know, if in the case that he gets, you know, hired for a second term, in the case that we do that, in the case that we can actually pull this off, you know, he's going to be a better second-term president than he was a first-term president. I solidly believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think that that's true. Well, it's been quite an adventure in these times, all the stuff going on, the increasing evidence of global warming stuff and climate change and the political climate and the attitudes people have and what Ariel was talking about in the beginning with the extreme polarization with people. These are interesting times. You know, in the midst of all this, we have Sexy Witch becoming a new hot bestseller. I think that that's just fascinating, you know.
That actually reminds me of something else I did leading up to the election, which I didn't mention to you guys leading up to this, but I actually I fundraised and self-published a chapbook of poetry called The Pussy Poems. And
what?
The Pussy Poems.
The Pussy Poems, great.
Yes, marvelous. And The Pussy Poems I actually wrote in 2003, but when the Vaginagate scandal happened with Representative Brown in Michigan, where there was an abortion, and this was in June, I believe there was an abortion law or bill being discussed on the floor, and she said the word vagina, and she was booted from the discussion.
I didn't have any
input into the conversation for 2 days, and another female speaker also was censured. So...
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I was like, oh, my God, you've got to be kidding me. So I published the Pussy Poems because, again, I'd retired them. I was like, I had them published. I'd performed them all over the place. Like, I did them as spoken word. I was done with them. I didn't think they were going to surface again, but it was called for. It was time to bring them back out. So I did, and people were like, I want a copy. Like, I want print, and I want to be able to give it to my friends and et cetera because it's a 14-piece, 28-page poem, basically.
Wow.
And it's very much, it's not a simple thing because it's our relationships, as women, our relationships with our reproductive and sexual organs is not a simple thing. And that's, you know, and that's why I think that's one of the reasons that Sexy Witch has been so profoundly affecting for people. And also one of the reasons that the Pussy Poems collection is also very, very deeply moving. And so I published it, and then all of the stuff started happening around the terms like legitimate rape. And
yeah.
And rape became a theme of this election.
Yeah, it did.
And it was appalling and heartbreaking to me.
Uh-huh.
And in that gave me sort of even more of a sense of publishing this book of poetry was the right thing to do. And I think, honestly, it was also part of what motivated me to come back and say, okay, yeah, obviously we still need to do the work. Like, we're still needing to do this work where we are liberating ourselves as women and men from our cultural assumptions around what it means to be women.
All right. Well, we need to take a little break right now, and then we'll be back with Lasara. So I would like to invite our listeners to please feel free to call in with questions or comments. The number is 347-308-8222.
Water shared is life shared. Founded by Oberon Zell in 1962, the Church of All Worlds is one of the oldest neo-pagan religions and the first to claim the identity of pagan. Inspired by Heinlein's sci-fi novel, Stranger in a Strange Land, CAW has been a major influence in the emergence of modern paganism. Originating the ritual of water sharing, CAW was the first church to legally ordain women as priestesses and to sanction gay and poly marriages. Thou art goddess, enter the nest at www.caw.org.
Before the internet, there was Green Egg, founded in 1968 by Oberon Zell. For over 40 years, Green Egg has been the leading journal of the emerging pagan movement, garnering numerous awards and worldwide recognition for its journal art, articles, and its controversial forum. Green Egg is now online as a beautiful full-color e-zine, edited by Ariel Montserrat and designed by Tom Donahue. Moreover, it's free. Collect back issues and subscribe at www.greeneggzine.com because legends never die.
Talking about her book, Sexy Witch, and her other current projects.
Lissara, I understand that Sexy Witch can be worked solo or as part of a group. What are some benefits of taking the course over working the book on one's own?
Well,
For some people, working solitary is the way that they do things best, and definitely that's if that's the case, then someone's going to be oriented in that direction to just work the book by themselves. However, a lot of us, I think, thrive in community, and especially with something that can be so potentially sort of foundationally, let's say, startling at times even, when we embark on the path of initiation, there's a level of awareness that we may or may not have from the outset that that things may get intense along the way, and especially when we're dealing with elements as deep as the stuff that we deal with in Sexy Witch, about body identity, about sexual identity, about spiritual power, about sexual power, and all of the things that we believe about it. We're also dealing with very, very personal stories that may come up, and not only our own personal stories, but the stories of our parents, our mothers, our grandparents. And when we have a group to process that with, one, there's a built-in network of support, right? We always know there's going to be somewhere that we can go and say, oh, my God, I just, you know, really hit a wall with this one, or, oh, my God, I just had the most amazing realization about how my healing is going to affect my children. I mean, that's happened for me before. And so we have somewhere where we can bring our experience. But in some ways, to me, even more amazing than that has been the ability or the opportunity to go and be part of a group and learn from the experience of other women. Like I said, I've done this group, you know, I don't even know how many times I've facilitated the Sexy Witch course as a teleclass. Off the top of my head, I don't know how many times I've done it. But every single time I've learned something that I would have had no other place to learn that thing. I've had experiences about my own ingrained sizism, for example. I've had experiences that illuminated for me the areas where I was self-judging without being aware of it and how my self-judging affected others. Are we live? Is that good? Did I just miss? Hello?
No,
no, hello.
Hey.
We're here.
I was like, wait, did I lose the connection?
No,
so,
no.
When we have the opportunity to come into shared space, we're coming into shared space and sharing our experiences as women. We're sharing our experiences as people, as initiates on the path, and we're creating magic together, the magic of transformation, which is a very deep and profound magic.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what kind of people really get the most out of reading Sexy Witch and those in also working the book as part of your group?
Well, I would see the funny thing, Arielle, I heard you say that your husband had read the book. I get, over the years, I've gotten an astounding number of letters from women that were at time, you know, some of them were light and beautiful, and some of them were deep and incredibly painful and also beautiful. You know, I've gotten letters from women who were moving into, you know, near to their croning and had never found their clitoris before. They didn't know where it was. And this was the first opportunity that they'd had to delve into themselves deeply enough to find that center.
Wow.
And at the same time, I've gotten so many letters from men thanking me for writing Sexy Witch, and often... and I've also had men take the course. The upcoming course is going to be female-identified only. But I have had mixed courses, one mixed course before. And some of the men who read Sexy Witch read it because they're in some ways female-identified, mm-hmm. and they want to learn more about the experience of being women from that perspective.
Mm.
Most letters that I've gotten from men, though, have been saying things like, if I had never read Sexy Witch, I would not have understood basic fundamental things about women that I understand now.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that has to do with some of the historical context that's brought into Sexy Witch. So Sexy Witch is there's a lot of research about women in our history drawn in to the book along the way, as well as, you know, the magical stuff and sort of self-examination. There's a lot of historical context brought in. There's a lot of media literacy stuff brought in. So basically we're working on a lot of different levels at the same time. And the men who write the most constant message has been, I would not have understood women the way that I understand them now if I hadn't read Sexy Witch. And one man wrote me a letter and said that his partner had gone away for a vacation for 2 weeks, and he'd read Sexy Witch while she was gone. And when she came back, she was like, have you been seeing someone else? You're like totally a different person.
Wow.
And he was like, no, I haven't. I read this book. And so both of them wrote me, because then she read the book too, and they shared it with each other. And and his relationship with her shifted so dramatically through reading the book that she was like, you've got to be learning this from somebody else. Like, something's going on here. And so they both wrote me a letter of thanks. But the beginning of the story was really funny because, you know, her assumption was that he had to be learning it from somewhere, so it must have been from someone else.
Well, that's a wonderful testimonial. It really is.
It's so good to get thank you notes like that.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It does. It's hugely rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And I have readers who've contacted me from Chile. I have readers who've contacted me from Mexico. I have readers who've contacted me from, you know, many, many different countries around the world. And even before Sexy Witch was translated into multiple languages, it was reviewed in 13 languages in the first year, one of them being Arabic.
Wow. Oh, Arabic. Oh, yeah, I can see where that would be a big, big successful thing there.
Which brings us to an interesting thing, too, which, you know, at some point, I'd let, you know, if I get back on the show, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about my experiences. I went to the Middle East in 2007, and I had my own rapid initiation cycle just living in the Middle East for a little while, and that really was a huge initiation for me, fundamentally changed some of my views of womanhood.
Mm-hmm. That was something I wanted to bring up tonight, because I remember the last time I saw you, which was a couple years ago, I think at Starwood, we had a conversation, and you were telling me about Palestine and what you had seen. Yeah,
it was amazing. I mean, I spent a considerable amount of time there in 2007 and experienced a very, very different dynamic of male-female relationship. And in my feminist expectations, you know, I was going to feel one way about it, and in the experience of it, I felt a very different way about it, which was that Middle Eastern men have an incredible level of worship of women that I didn't know. I didn't know that before I was there.
Yes.
We don't get to hear that part of the story very often.
We don't, and I couldn't agree more, Lazara. I've known many, many, many Muslim people and people from Middle East when I lived in San Francisco City in the late 70s. A lot of people were leaving Iran because it had become fundamentalist. And so, you know, I met them in various capacities. I found that a lot. And, yeah, the macho kind of things out there, again, that's part of the fundamentalism I thought. You know, or I think, and just as it is here in our country with Christianity and all of the remarks about legitimate rape, etc.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Although I would take the word macho out of that and put some other word there, because one of the that I experienced as actually being really beautiful that I'd never, I grew up really rugged and strong and, you know, second wave feminist ideologies and, mm-hmm. women, we do it for ourselves and, mm-hmm. you know, and my own personal experience of growing up, you know, feeling very much like I had to protect myself from the masculine in a lot of ways. And then I went to the Middle East, and I went to Palestine specifically, as you said, and the cultural set there is that you allow men to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I went through just a really rapid shift in my experience of what it meant to allow men to take care of me. Mm-hmm. I was like, whoa, what is that? What does that even mean?
Yeah.
What do you mean allow men to take care of me? You know, and I did. I allowed the men that I knew to take care of me in ways that that I wouldn't have in the U.S. because the roles are different here. But I came back, and my own desires around relationship had shifted dramatically, and the relationship that I'm in now is very different than a relationship that I would have been in without that experience.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, we need to take another little break right now, and again, I invite our listeners to please feel free to call in with comments or questions. The number is 347-308-8222. That's the cue. Hello, Tracy.
Maybe we aren't having a break tonight.
maybe we're not. I don't know. Hey, Tracy.
They changed our union contract.
Boy, I guess
you know.
So.
Learn real magic from the pros. Get your magical training at our online Academy of Arcana. Receive personalized instruction from a faculty of 30 renowned authors, teachers, and practitioners representing a spectrum of magical arts and traditions. Oberon Zell's Gray School of Wizardry offers 375 classes in 16 departments for adults and youth ages 11 and up. The school includes clubs, forums, competitions, and other social activities, including summer campouts. Graduates are certified as journeyman wizards. Check out this unique school and enroll at www.grayschool.com.
Sacred art for your magical life. Mythic Images is dedicated to the rebirth of mythology and the awakening of Gaia.
Hey,
we invite you to explore a collection of pagan and goddess-oriented
and
images, including Oberon's famous millennial Gaia.
Yeah, that's what
Oberon
we're talking about.
And Morning Glory Zell create museum-quality replicas, devotional statuary, books, posters, and magical jewelry for Wicca, pagan, and all nature-based religions. Explore the Mythic Images catalog at www.mythicimages.com.
All right.
Thanks for sticking around through our commercial break. If you don't already have a Blog Talk Radio account, you can get one for free by simply registering. And now, back to the magical world of Oberon and Ariel.
All right, this is Oberon, and we're back here on Over to Oberon and Ariel with our special guest, Lasara Firefox Allen. We're talking about her book, Sexy Witch, and her other current projects. Lasara, would you tell us a little what your personal practice consists of?
Absolutely. Before we do that, though, I want to say one more thing about Palestine, which is...
Oh, sure, please. Yeah.
I just really quick want to let people know that that just today, and this is treading on tender territory, but I just want to let people know that today the Israeli military assassinated the Hamas military chief in Gaza.
Whoa.
And Israel is actually invading Gaza right now. So I feel like it's incumbent upon me to let people know these things because we don't hear it in the mainstream news. And so if any of you listeners feel motivated, do your research, check it out, see what's going on for yourself, and if you feel inclined, write a letter to President Obama. I'm certainly going to be doing so because I would really love to see him take a stance on what's happening there. And I know that he really had to sort of ride a fine line with the election, and, of course, we don't want to make an enemy of Israel by any stretch, but we are hoping that peace is possible in the Middle East. And I don't think that wiping out Gaza or the West Bank is the way to achieve that. So,
oh, boy, what a tar baby. Ah, man.
So I just wanted to put it out there and let people know that this just happened just hours ago, and it's a really, really big deal. So, moving on, though.
Moving on.
The question was my personal
about your personal practice, yes.
Okay, my personal practice. Well, you know, a big part of my personal practice is about cultivating compassion. Mm-hmm. And working with topics like Israel and Palestine is one of the ways that I work on that. It's a stretch, but it's a stretch that I do for the good of for the benefit of all beings. And I have a lot of different practices that are from a lot of different traditions. And because I've studied a lot of different traditions, and a lot of them make sense to me. Having gone to the Middle East, I studied Islam, and I've studied the mystics from all sorts of different traditions. I won't say all of them because, you know, that's probably impossible, but I've studied from a number of different religions. And mysticism is an interesting thing because there is a mystical branch to almost every established religion. And so... And the mystics, to me, the mystics are all speaking the same language. The mystics are all saying the same thing.
Yeah, I find this to be true, too.
And so a lot of my practices have to do with mysticism. A lot of my practices have to do with, I also do a lot of Tibetan Buddhist practices. But the most important practices to me are the basic sort of mundane everyday practices. And what I mean by that is just living in consciousness as much of the time as possible. So when I misstep, to take responsibility for that and to make the necessary apologies or actions that will bring things back into balance as quickly as possible. For example, in our house we have an agreement about we don't fight in our house. I mean, you know, not that no one ever. I don't think anyone can ever say we never fight, but we have agreements in our house about how we go through disagreements. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is, you know, if someone's using a tone, one of us can say, "You're using a tone." And the other person's supposed to hear that and say, "Oh, I'm using a tone," and alter their behavior or apologize or try to more clearly explain what it is they're trying to get at. And so... I expect that of my children, and I also expect my children to call me on it, and they do. They do. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm using a tone, they say, "Mom, you're using a tone," and I have to say, "You're right. I'm using a tone. I'm sorry. What's going on for me is this thing, and you know, and here's what I want to do to make it. I'm listening to you, and I want to make it different." And so. We have ways of offering the other person an opportunity to show up more consciously, and so a big practice for me is what would be called householding in Tibetan in the Tibetan lineage or in Indian traditions. The path of the householder is the person who takes their spiritual practice and applies it in their household. So my relationship with my husband, my relationship with my children, and my relationship with my community and extended family. And also, at the heart of it and easily forgotten but most important is my relationship with myself. So self-care is a huge practice for me, and that's something that Sexy Witch focuses on a lot, actually, in the process of learning how to make ourselves the truest, you know, me that I can be. I have to actually learn who that person is. And I have to do that through reflection and through practice and through sitting with myself. And I also have to learn how to love myself just as well as I love other people. I have to learn how to take care of myself as well as I take care of other people. I think for a lot of women, and some men too, but I think traditionally in our culture at least, it's a very female oriented tendency to take care of the needs of others before ourselves. I'm not saying guys don't do this at all. I'm just saying culturally women have been ingrained into that behavior. And so for me, a big part of my practice is remembering to do things like exercise, take a bath mm-hmm. when I need to, eat properly. And I also, you know, I'm going to come totally clean, and I have bipolar disorder. And so learning to manage bipolar disorder has been a huge part of my personal practice. And that has to do with doing these things that I'm talking about, you know, being righteous in relationships, being good to myself, taking care of myself physically and emotionally and psychologically and spiritually. All of those things matter, and all of those things make me a healthier person. So for me, there's not some big separation between spiritual life and mundane life. They're all kind of the same.
All right.
Yeah. Wow. So, do you consider yourself a pagan, Lasara?
Well, I consider myself a mystic.
Okay.
Because I think that, you know, as I said, all traditions, all organized religions, all established religions have their branch of mysticism, and I could say I'm a mystic pagan. But it's almost redundant. I think just saying I'm a mystic is the most accurate thing that I can call myself at this point in time. And that all that means to me is that I draw on the teaching of all of the different teachers,
mm-hmm.
you know, living and dead, that all of these teachers are available, all these different views that we can look through and see the face of God or goddess. And to me, when I say God or goddess, it's an entity beyond gender, beyond sexual identity. It's that's one of the things actually that I loved about Islam, was the way that you describe God in Islam is by non-describing. You say God is not this, God is not this, God is not this, God is not this, and to give God attributes is to limit God.
So you've been now you're teaching yourself, so you're passing on the teachings. Do you feel that teaching is your calling?
I absolutely do, actually. I tried to get away from it. And, you know, Oberon, you and I have had conversations about this before. You know, where you've said, you know, when the goddess says, you know, calls, you know, you answer, right? But
right.
I you know, my thing is that, you know, when deity says, when it says jump, all I can say is how high.
Yeah.
You know? And so so it, you know, I tried to retire, and it didn't work. So I'm in it to win it, in it for the long haul.
Yeah. So, Lasara, are you raising your daughters in the craft? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you know, what's funny is about a year and a half ago, a year ago, not this past summer, but the summer before, my older daughter, Aurora, went and stayed with Oberon and Morning Glory for 3 weeks, I think it was. I don't remember.
Yeah, it was a fostering. It was really great.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful thing.
And how that came about was that she and I were having a conversation, and I don't even remember. We were driving. I remember where we were, but I don't remember how it came up. And I said something about, well, we aren't. She said something about a ritual or ceremony, something she wanted to go to, or some. Maybe she asked why we didn't have Samhain parties anymore or something. I don't remember. Something along those lines. And I said, well, you know, I kind of left the community, you know. And at the time, I had left the community. And she said, well, you did, Mom. You left. But you didn't ask me if I wanted to leave.
Oh.
And at the time, she was, I think, 14.
Yeah.
13 probably. And I said, okay, all right, well, you have plenty of teachers. who would love to take you on, and let's figure out how to get you the teaching that you want, you know. And so she went, and that's how that came about. And she went and she learned with you guys, and she has her own practices, and now actually she and I are doing some witchcrafting together, because I have really come back to it in a large way, because that's what deity has been asking me to do. And so I've come back to the community, and I've come back to witchcraft, and like the comment about tarot, I'm doing tarot readings again, and it's amazing. It's amazing. I love doing the readings. I've been coaching for many years now, and I hadn't been doing professional readings, and then I started doing professional readings again, and I was like, oh, my God, this is, like, just as effective as coaching for the right person. Like, one person's going to respond better to a tarot reading than to a coaching session. Another person's going to respond better to coaching. But the tarot readings can be so incredibly powerful. And Aurora and I are actually making talismans together. We're making spells. And we actually are doing a little business called Mother and Daughter Creations. And doing handmade spell kits and things like that. And we're not doing it on any large scale at this point, and probably won't, but it's fun and it feels good, and we're getting to share the experience of both a spiritual endeavor and a creative endeavor, and having fun doing it. My younger daughter, Salome, is going to be 13 in a few days. And she is basically, she's otaku, which is, she's like into anime. That's her whole thing. She's into anime and World of Warcraft, and she's queer, and she's quirky, and she's absolutely her own beautiful little soul, and absolutely unique and individual, and she doesn't identify as pagan at all or as a witch even, but she does absolutely relate to the ideas of magic and shape-shifting, and a lot of anime actually has those themes ingrained.
Well, both of those girls are just amazing, and I just find them just delightful to be around them. I think you're doing a great job with them.
I think they're pretty cool.
They really are. while we've just got a few minutes left, can you say anything about this Beloved Festival life? What's that?
Beloved Festival was actually really fun. We went to Beloved Festival. Robert and I went and taught together for the first time this summer. We taught in Portland, and then we went and taught at Beloved Festival up in Oregon, and that was it was a great experience. We got to teach together. We got to meet a bunch of really great people, and it's quite a great festival. I absolutely recommend going. It's a really diverse mix of people, diverse offerings of workshops from all sorts of different paths, and musicians and artists from all sorts of different genres. And it's not huge. It's not a huge festival at all, but it's super diverse and very fun.
All right.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like fun. So what's next for you? I understand you're starting a new project in January with your Sexy Witch, a new course?
Yeah. Yes, I am doing that. I mean, right now, through the holidays, it's going to be really about promoting the Sexy Witch telecourse and hopefully, reminding people that they can get gift certificates for tarot readings for their loved ones if they don't want to buy them the Sexy Witch course, something a little bit, scaled down a little bit, but equally wonderful. So definitely going to be working that through the holidays. My next big project that I hope to do, and things shift all the time, and who knows what this is, if this will be it, but my feelers are out right now on co-editing an anthology called Feminism and the New Inclusivity: Welcome to the Big Tent. And Big Tent Politics is about not having one defining aspect be it for the whole group. So moving away from a westernized bias toward a more global identity around feminism. So really trying to draw the conversation from people in third world countries. What does feminism look like in Latin America? What does
That's really great, and I really like this whole big tent idea. I've tried to do that all my life as well. And that's it for the. We're come to the end of our time, our end of our hour. So thank you very much for being our guest tonight, Lissara. It was great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Yeah. Have a wonderful night, you guys.
Thank you.
You too, Lissara. Good luck with everything.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
So, Ariel, what are we planning for next week's show?
Well, next week is the night before Thanksgiving, and I have a little Thanksgiving tale that I'd like to share with everybody because it's the most unusual Thanksgiving tale I've ever heard of.
So. Well, we look forward to hearing the story then.
So anyway, and so it's just us two because it's the last. Well, no, it isn't the last Wednesday of the month. But anyway, it's the night before Thanksgiving, so that's why we're doing that way.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that's our show for tonight, and be sure to tune in then next Wednesday, same pagan time, same pagan station, and be sure to check out Lissara's website at lassaraallen.com. That's LASARALLEN.com.
Mm-hmm.
So merry meet.
And merry part.
And merry meet again.
Good night, Tom and Aubrey.
Thank you for joining us on WSI-sponsored Pagans Tonight Radio Network. You can hear us every night right here on Blog Talk Radio or download us later on iTunes. Please check our schedule for accurate show times. For all questions, comments, or show suggestions, you can email us at pagans tonight@gmail.com. And let us know how we're doing. We'd love to hear from you. You can also visit us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on LiveJournal. We invite you to tune in again tomorrow night. Good night, and blessed be.